Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to New Books in Indian Religions, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, I have the pleasure today of welcoming back to the podcast Dr. Patrick Olivelle, who is Professor Emeritus at the University of Texas at Austin and a former president of the American Oriental Society and a prolific and significant contributor to the field of Indian religions broadly. We will be focusing our conversation today on the third volume of collected essays of his, recently published by Primus, called Reading Texts and Narrating History. Patrick, welcome back to the podcast.
Thank you, Raj.
So tell us a bit about perhaps the impetus behind this collected volume and perhaps its relationship, or make mention of the previous two.
Yeah, the previous ones were published quite many years ago, 2006 and 2007. So this is, 15 years or so later. So it contains my publications of the last, 15 years or so. it covers a wider range of subjects and topics than my first two volumes. The first two volumes covered a period when I was really a young man, which is a long time ago. My interests have, gradually developed, changed, I'd say. And I had a wider repertoire of material, texts with which I have worked, which were not represented in the first two volumes. The three areas which I have worked on the last 20 years or so were, of course, the Dharmashastras, which I had been working on it even earlier than that. But after that, I became more closely interested in Kautilya's Arthashastra, which I translated. And when you translate a text, you have an intimacy with the text that you don't when you just read a text. And then another book that I worked on by translating it first and then working on material within it was Ashwaghosha's Buddha Charita and his repertoire of work. So those are the three areas from which I have drawn for many of the papers that I included in the volume. Either they are directly connected to these three areas or they have been inspired by that. For example, the very first article, first paper I have is on the medical profession in ancient India, a topic which I had no interest in the early part of my career, but became interested in that because medical professionals play a significant role in Kautilya's Arthashastra, because people who are medical professionals of some sort were important for both the military aspects of a king, as well as his animals. You know, elephants and horses were the mainstay of the army of Kautilya, and they had to have veterinarians. So vets and doctors or medical professionals, there is no distinction in terms of terminology. So they have the same terms, the chikitsaka, that is being called. So I became interested in that. And then, of course, went on to looking at these terms in the medical text, the Charaka and the Shushruta Sanghitas. And that's how that particular paper came into being. I was also asked by Professor Preissendanz of Vienna to write for a journal that is the European Journal of Ayurveda or Indian Medicine. So that's how. So in a sense, this is sort of the intellectual milieu in which I worked for this book, as opposed to the older ones, which were of a different period of my life. Yeah.
A number of points, just off the top of my head. One, you know that one is productive, indeed prolific, when one has two volumes of collected essays published, and then 15 years go by, and then there's enough for a third volume in which there are no less than 28 contributions. So we have to say a word about your process and your productivity. We'll put a pin in that. I'll plot that into the GPS for the ride today. Secondly, it's interesting to say when you were a young man, I'm at an age where I'm in my 40s. So for undergrads, I'm old without question. And then from those of your age group, I'm a young man. So it's all relative, I suppose.
Certainly, yes. I was the chair of the Department of Religious Studies at Indiana University when you were born. That puts into perspective.
Yes, that reminds me of things I'd say to folks who were born in the year that I graduated high school, or watching a classic movie over the holidays such as Home Alone, and the whole problem is there because they don't have smartphones. They can't contact their kid who's home. It's a whole different world. Anyhow, there are a number of things that I want to touch on. Let's talk about this. What's your process like? You're extraordinarily productive. I've been told that I'm no slouch myself, but nevertheless, what is your process like? What does that look like? Is there a particular regimen? Is there a particular time of day or time of year that you produce? Or could you tell us a bit about the process, if you don't mind?
Well, I don't know. I don't have any particular secret to what I'm doing. I try to work every day, including weekends. And I try to have maybe two or three projects going on at the same time. And there are some projects that can be done on the fly while I'm in the airport, in a plane, watching news on TV. I can still type away. That does not require the kind of intellectual engagement and focus that other would. If I'm translating, I require a lot more attention and a lot more things around me, dictionaries and books and all that. But when I'm doing a critical edition, I'm transcribing manuscripts and doing all of that is a sort of a very mechanical thing, which can be done anywhere. So I'm trying to have many things going at the same time where I can, when I have quality time here in my, where I'm seated right now, I will be able to work on the more intense things that require focus. And when I'm somewhere else, in my office in the university when I was not yet retired, I could work for half an hour here, 2 hours there or 1 hour there, and then fill those things. So I've been working like that. So there's nothing very special about it. The range of topics that I cover here, to a degree, it is dictated by my interest. To a degree, it depends on somebody asked me to give a talk or write a paper, and there's a topic there. I'm asked to work on justice, for example. That paper on justice here. Then I was asked to come to Erfurt. They're having this international conference on the ideas of justice. So I had to work it up in a sense. It was not something that I would have done if I was not invited. I was asked to work for a workshop at the CSDS in Delhi. Professor Rajiv Bhargavan was working at the time on ends of man, the goals of human beings in various religions and various cultures. And that's where I came up with this thing on the Trivarga or the Purusharta in India, which had been misrepresented for a long time. The problem I find is many people who deal with these things often do not go back to the sources and look at them closely, comparatively, diachronically, in the original language rather than in some translated thing. So that's I think, something that I try to do. And, you know, sometimes it's worth remembering that language is made up of words, right? It's a simple thing, but we often forget. And words are like archaeological artifacts. And when you plumb their depth, you find you can write a history, just like you can write a history through looking at pottery, different kinds of pottery. When I talked to you last time, we talked about the term grasta, right? I think we did, right? And you find that the word is not there before about the third century, right? So then you ask, what happened, right? Then you have an archaeological sort of a discovery using the archaeology of text rather than realia. So I think that's what I have been trying to do in many of my works. Yeah.
Well, you've touched on a question that I was going to ask, but you've already opened that door, which is great, which is to flesh out and elucidate your core methodology, because so much of your findings are clearly the correlates or evolutes of this particular methodology that you're so masterful at, which you would describe as looking at words, perhaps realizing that language is comprised of words, examining words, comparing their usages over time. And, you know, I suppose it's summed up well in the name of this collection, Reading Texts and Narrating History. But in your own words, say a bit more about the method that you've adopted, perhaps how it's been altered or changed or enhanced or clarified over the years, and perhaps even say a word about where that fits in, you know, the trajectory of scholarship over the last few decades.
Yeah. So I use the term philology. I used it in a paper here that I wrote on mining, mines for metallurgy. Philology has got a bad name today, right? In fact, I cite their author who published a paper who said, philology is dead. Nobody talks about philology anymore. Shelley Pollock has written on this quite a lot. If philology is dead, then the whole enterprise of reading ancient texts is also dead. Philology ultimately is the close reading of texts. And I tell my students, if you don't have any respect for the people you study, then you can talk about them without bothering to listen to them. I'm sorry, there is a phone going in the background. what I'm trying to say is that if I'm respecting my sources, the people from the way back 2,000 years ago talking to me, then I have the obligation to understand what they're saying. To understand what they are saying, I have to know their language. I cannot be like a modern anthropologist or ethnographer who goes to the field with no knowledge of the language in which people are talking. So he has to have an interpreter. And the interpreter may or may not be translating exactly what is being said. I have to have the respect to understand what my interlocutors, what the people in the past are telling me. So I have to learn the language. And to learn the language in a way that I can understand what they are saying. That is philology. Philology is the serious engagement with language and the language in which ancient peoples wrote and what they have written that we today read and understand. So I think that is the first thing. And what helped me, quite by accidentally, I mean, many things in my life have been accidents, good accidents, but nevertheless accidents, is that when I first started doing my PhD, I don't know why, I did for my PhD a critical edition and a translation that set me on the path to deep engagement with texts and to know that texts are not given. So for example, a text is written 500 AD, right? 1,500 years ago. We don't have that person's autograph. Right? What we have is what has been repeatedly transcribed by people over and over and over again. So in a sense, the critical edition is trying to find out through taking away many of the dross, many of the mistakes, to come as close to as possible. You can never go back to the original, close to as possible, the original text, right? Which means that you are seeing the history of a text, which is as important as going to the origin. Just like a child born has, the birth is important, but birth is not the only event in that person's life. It continues into old age. Just like a text, when it is written and then thrown into the world, it has a life of its own. It is being read, interpreted, transcribed, rewritten, commented on, thought about. All that is the life of a text. And it is, I think, the work with the manuscripts that are the only things we have with regard to the text that gives us this life of the text, I think. Which means that you are getting very closely engaged with the text. When you translate it, then every word counts, every sentence counts. So we are trying to understand what the original says, and then to reproduce it in this new target language, which is always a difficult thing. Like Italians used to say, traditori sono traduttori. So translators are traitors. Yes, it's always there's a certain amount of being traitor because you cannot exactly reproduce what is in there. This is especially true of a poetic work like the Buddhacharita, right? Less so in a legal work like Manu's Code. It's much easier to translate that. So I think it is this is what I'm trying to say, is that this early training of mine gave me a sort of way of engaging with the past. In, I think, hopefully a responsible way. And I'm glad that I've been able to produce editions and translations that could be used by others who may not be as equipped or as having the mental
trained
training and also, you know,
aptitude.
It is a boring thing. As I said, I'm working when I'm in an airport, right? It's sometimes the boring thing, and a lot of people don't like that. They like to go the flash. So I hope that I can my work in these areas will open up some of the texts for further study.
Oh, well, there's no question about it that they have, without question. I mean, there are many a specialist in another subfield of Indian religions, such as myself, who derive a great deal of support from the works that you produce. So yes, you do that heavy lifting for many scholars throughout the field, and probably for those engaging the text for generations to come. But also, your particular scholarly MO evidences the utility, in your case, of philology for other findings. The things that you stumble upon while sitting there and doing the bot work, as it were, the computing, yeah. You stumble upon things. And so do you want to say a little bit about that, perhaps?
Yes. For example, I've been working on the Dharmashastra texts, right, for a long time. One real problem with all the ancient Indian texts, especially the Dharmashastra, is chronology. When were they written? If a text was written in the second century after Christ or third century before Christ, that's 500 years. That's twice the length of Canada and and America's existence, right? That's a long period of time. When we deal with ancient Indian texts, they say, oh, it's maybe between 500 BC and 280, 700 years. How can you make history if you look at a text that is written within a period of 700 years, right? That's not possible. So, but there were no external criteria for dating these texts. And you say that, okay, so I was working on something quite different and was working on this Professor Malamud's Festschrift. He was retiring, and Collège de France in Paris had this big conference. I was giving a paper on that, and I was working on this, and I was looking at the term Dvija, right? A twice born, which is a very common term that is used. Any introduction to Indian religion says that, right?
Throughout the Puranas.
Yes.
Throughout the Puranas, for example.
Yes, and we have, I took it all my life to be there from the very beginning. It's something that's, you know, common Indian. And I found that before the Dharma Sutra of Gautama, probably the second or maybe even the first century, the word is absent in the Sanskrit vocabulary or in the Indian vocabulary. Dvija. Even in the Dharma Sutra of Apastamba, which is prior to the Gautama, the word is not used. So I was able then to say, okay, whenever the word Dvija arises in a text, it must be post second century. And even a stronger sort of dating that you find is Patanjali's, his Mahabhashya on Panini, enormous treasury of Indian culture, right? Because he gives examples over and over again for Sanskrit rules of grammar, examples taken from ordinary language. And the word Dvija doesn't occur at all in that whole big text. Right? So it's very clear that the term Dvija started at a particular time in Indian history. So there's at least a marker there that we can use to distinguish. So this is one small example that if you do language or word excavation, one may be able to come up with unforeseen discoveries with regard to the chronology of text, which we can say very clearly that the Mahabharata is clearly post second, first century before Christ, because Dvija, Dvijottama, Dvija Sattama, that's everywhere, almost in every on every page, right? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. So
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
How is the volume structured? So there are three sections, and perhaps we can say, I mean, I can't convey to the audience, I mean, many of my colleagues listening probably already have procured a copy or will soon, or their university libraries have, but there is an extraordinary breadth of topics that's covered in this collected work. And it's divided into three overarching sections. Part one is called History and Material Culture. Do you want to say a word or two about the types of studies we find here, maybe make mention of a couple of the highlights?
Yeah, so when I say material culture here, the three parts are sort of post-factum constructions, as you can see, right? It's not something that I had in mind when I was writing these things, but I had these 28 and I was trying to see how can I make sense of what I have here. And I talked with my good friend and former student, Donald Davis here, and we actually moved around some of these things from one side to the other. When I say material culture, I mean something that is that could be called realia, that we are dealing with real things, medicine and medical professionals, long distance trade in goods, elephants. I have this little thing on showbiz, which came from also from Arthashastra, you know, how the entertainment industry in ancient India worked. Those sort of the material culture that I'm dealing with. And the second part deals with law and society, which is mostly dealing with legal matters, such as courts, such as judges, and war and peace, the various ways in which statecraft functioned in ancient India, and stuff like that. And the final one, which is sort of a catch-all thing, which is religion and culture, and I deal with things that are more closely related to the religious culture of ancient India, where I have this thing on the Trivarga and Purusharatha, and something that, you know, Don Davis liked, the one thing on fame, which is a topic that has not received attention of scholars, the importance of the idea of fame, which comes principally in ancient times from the warrior tradition. You fight for your fame, right? The infamy is worse than death, kind of thing. So those are the things that I have in the last one. The last one is the least focused. First two are a little more focused, I think. Whatever I could not put in the first two, I put in the third.
Don Davis has actually, of course, been on the podcast, and he wrote a quite useful introduction, I would say.
Right. He's very good at writing introductions.
I think, if as I recall correctly, there's a line either here or elsewhere where you say that he's essentially refined the art of writing introductions.
Right.
Yeah. I would be inclined to agree, actually. There's so many. So earlier you mentioned that your interests had changed over the years. Tell us a bit about that, and perhaps you can fold in a little text called the Arthashastra.
Yeah, a little text, yeah. my intellectual trajectory went from my early work in Oxford in the area of Buddhist monasticism. My first love was Buddhism. But from there, when I came to University of Pennsylvania, for a variety of reasons, I shifted my focus onto the Brahmanical tradition from the Buddhist. But I maintained a focus on asceticism and the monastic culture. So my early work then, let's say for the first 10 years or so, from the mid-1970s to the mid-1980s, or even later, were mostly focused on ascetics and ascetic life, and that you can see in my, if you look at my CV, you'll see all of them around there. I find, looking back, rather a boring period of my life. I'm doing the same thing. Towards the end of the 1980s, beginning of the 1990s, especially after I left Bloomington, Indiana, and came to University of Texas, a change in scenery, change of people, change in people with whom I was talking, I went more and more into Dharmashastra as such, into the legal literature. So that was my turning point. And there were other forays which are sometimes integrally connected to this, sometimes not. For example, one of my last works on the ascetic tradition was the translation of the Sannyasa Upanishads, which came around 1992. And because of that, Oxford, the editor of the World's Classic Series in Oxford, asked me to translate the major Upanishads. I had no intention of doing that. I didn't know I was qualified to do that. I said no first, and she came back. Then I said, okay, I take the December to do a pilot translation. And I did it and became interested in it. So I ended up translating the Upanishads, which was rewarding, and it came out well. Won an award also. And that was, I think, I was not a Vedic specialist. So it was, you know, one small area there. More integral to my work was my passage into the Arthashastra that happened in the 2013, 2014, that period. It was mostly because one of my students, Mark McLeish, did his PhD on the Arthashastra. And I became naturally interested in it because I was working with him. And then I thought I should translate it because I didn't find Kangle's translation very appealing. So that I got into it and worked closely with Professor Wetzler, Albrecht Wetzler, who was a great German scholar, who is right now actually, you know, still alive, but, you know, can't work very well. That's how I came into that. So it's been, going into back to Buddhism with Ashwaghosha, I was asked by the Clay Sanskrit Library to work on Ashwaghosha's Buddha Charita. Somebody else was working on the Saundarananda. So I got interested in that and then spent about 5 years dealing with Ashwaghosha. So there, yeah, they're a little eclectic, but there are connections here.
It seems that your in terms of interest, your your sannyasa was earlier in your career.
Sorry?
You're interested in sannyasa was earlier in your career.
Yes, right. Yeah, the first period of my trial, rather than the last.
Yeah, yeah. And now it's, you're doing it backwards. So now you're in
the
householder phase. You're in the most productive phase now. Yeah. Excellent. So a couple of things that you mentioned. I mean, there's so many themes, and there's we would have to have a 5-hour podcast. But let me touch on a couple of things you mentioned in passing. One, why do you feel that philology, as you say, has a bad name these days? Would you say a bit about that?
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know how it got a bad name. I think it has something to do with the modernist period, where I think how Indology got a bad name, for example, how the very term Oriental got a bad name, right? I mean,
I see.
It's so, in a sense, the words get bad names the way it is used. If Orientalism, what's his name, didn't write the book on the Orientalism, forget
Edward
his name.
Said.
Maybe we would still be using the term Oriental without any bad connotation, right? I think the intellectual climate of the 1990s, 2000 had something to do with it. But my problem is not so much the word. I mean, you can use different words. My problem is
the enterprise,
the reality of it, yeah, what is behind it, you know, that people become less interested in actually dealing with the original languages and dealing with it seriously, because it requires work. It requires a lot of labor. It is not always sexy. You will not be quoted in the New York Times. That is an issue. There was actually this guy from, what's his name, from Cambridge, who did this thing on Panini that came, might be the first time a Panini has come into the pages of BBC and New York Times, you know. philology is a difficult and lonely enterprise, but people, I mean, you look at a word, you know, I get this thing every day, a word from, what's his name now? I'm terrible at names, from Seattle, the Indian, who was a computer scientist and now works in language. And here you get the whole story of a word, which is wonderful to read, right? It's great. It takes me 5 minutes to read it at the most or less, but the amount of work that has gone into producing that 3-minute read, right? It's the excavation of the origins of a word. When we look at the OED, Oxford English Dictionary, take the word and you see all the things that, when it was first used, how its meaning changed from 18th century to the 21st century. This is all philology that gives us this history of language. And without that, we won't be able to understand 18th century use of language if you use the 21st century meanings of those words, right? So this is the issue that I think is so important to understand. And it is a tough thing for that in the modern university. The universities are less and less inclined to deal with these kinds of areas. Even the University of London eliminated its professorship in archaeology, classical archaeology. So it's a tough intellectual environment for this kind of work, but I think it is still important for our field.
Fascinating. I had invited Peter Bishop and Yuko Yokochi to do a joint podcast to showcase their their, you know, painstaking and significant work creating a critical edition of the Skanda Purana, and as patchwork and sprawling as the Puranas are, the Skanda probably takes the cake in that regard. And so this is important work, and it was important. I'd come across something that Peter Bishop wrote, actually, and I thought, let me invite him on to share with folks how important enterprise of philology is, how significant it is in terms of it's not really it's podcast host Raj that folks here. It's not so much critical engagement, conference questions, pushback. That's not the enterprise. I mean, in my own work, I've been critical of historicist and philological looking to the Puranas for those aims alone, but it ought to be implied that, of course, narratology and philology go hand in hand. How can one really function without the other? I mean, my own work seeks synchronic strategies for engaging texts such as the Puranas, the Devi Mahatmya, the Mahabharata, but of course they're diachronically produced, and of course you know, the work that folks like you do is invaluable.
I mean, one has to be careful, because I'm never trying to downplay the importance that a text has for a contemporary audience.
That's a really important point. I'm glad you touched on that.
But that does not mean that they did not have
a historical reception.
People 300 years ago, 700 years ago, 1,000 years ago, and when it was written. So one does not invalidate the others. This is, as I said, it's a life. You know, your 20-year-old Raj Balkaran does not invalidate the 40-year-old. And hopefully the 40-year-old will not be invalidated by the 80-year-old as I am today, right? So this is the, I think these are false choices. The importance, one other thing is, when I say that the Upanishads, when it says X, means this, but people like Shankara and other people in the 20th century think that it means something different, these are not contradictory things.
Well, that's the power of having this. One can't begin to study South Asia, in my view, or even the humanities, without being able to hold, having multivalent thinking and being able to hold paradoxes. I mean, there's no. Right. I mean, the luster of a gem is through the light hitting the different faces of it, and so
I'm reading the Upanishads as a historian, as a textual scholar. Shankara is reading it
as an exegete,
a theologian, to find out some universally valid truths. But of course, Shankara's interpretation of this is different from Ramanuja's, right? And that is different from someone else's, third person. So in a sense, the history of theology is a history of reinterpreting texts. These are all valid enterprises within their own domains. It becomes invalid when they say, originally, historically, in the 8th century before Christ, it meant this.
Yes. Right?
I'm not saying that the 8th century meaning is more important than the
21st century.
Years later. Those are value judgments we can't make. Those are different. That's all we can say. Mm. Right? Yeah. Okay. Problem with translating then. What am I translating? Am I translating an 8th century before Christ work, or am I translating it through the eyes of Shankara in the 7th century after Christ, 1,000 years later? Both can be done, but they will give very different results.
Brilliant perspective. And so part of what I've been striving to do is to, in my view, sort of supplement or alter a trajectory of scholarship on the Puranas that have looked at them solely for historicist or philological aims for mining for data, glossing over the narrative power.
Right.
Right. So they're both without question vital aspects of any text. So I want to touch on one final tidbit that you mentioned in passing, and as I said, with a contribution as rich as this, and a scholar as seasoned as yourself, we could easily fill 3 hours. I have no doubt of that. But I want to touch on this tantalizing idea that I would readily agree with. But I want to hear you say more about that translating a text is more intimate an enterprise than interpreting a text. Say a bit about that and your own sort of experience translating.
Yeah, I would say not so much that it's different from interpreting. It is different from interpreting. But I think translating a text is a different enterprise than reading a text. Whether it is reading in the original or reading in the translation, some translation. Because I have read texts in the original. When you are reading a text, you are trying to get a meaning out of it. What is this person trying to say? You don't pay as much attention to every word, every phrase, every expression. And what is more, you don't look at how a particular word is used by this author throughout his text. You are just reading one page at a time. When you're translating, you're trying to translate a term and you want to be consistent because there is no one-to-one equivalent between a Sanskrit word and an English word. So you are trying to have a word that as closely approximates the original as possible. But your question is, what is the original? You can't go to a dictionary, because dictionary will give you 10 different meanings. What I'm trying to do is to say, go and find out all the places where this author uses this term. Go to the context of each of those things. How is he using it? Is he using in two or three different ways? Or just one way? So there's you are sort of digging deeper into a text, and therefore deeper into the way the text came out of the mind and the hand of the author, in a way that when I'm reading it, I'm not. I'd say when you're reading it, you are at the surface of the text. When you're translating it, you are at a deeper level, close to the mind of the author, close, but not there. Clearly, we can't get into the mind of the author because it is mediated by the written word. But you are closer to it because you are looking at it as closely as possible. It's and the word that is being used, the close reading of text. The closest reading of a text is a translation.
Beautiful.
That's it. Yeah.
Beautiful. Or it's certainly a translation necessitates the closest reading, and the image of perhaps a somewhat crude but apt metaphor of a cow chewing its cud, a regurgitation requires digestion for something to be refined, right? Like in order to articulate it, there has to be some level, assuming of course the articulation is similar or appropriate or commensurate with the original, then there has to be a digestion of it on some level.
It has to be, and this is where the choice often a literal and a literary translation. Literal, I don't think there is a distinction between the two, because you cannot really have a literal translation. Translation is taking what you say in English and me saying the same thing as close to it as possible in Sinhalese, which is my own mother tongue, right? Those are the two ways of what I'm doing it. Literal will mean take one word and translate it, take another word and translate it. You won't get a real meaning, right, out of it. So in a sense, that's why I have never used parenthetical. You know, you see in translation often in parentheses, right? What needs, because if you need a parenthesis, then you haven't understood the text. Or the text requires the parenthetical statement, then use it, right? You're not trying to translate words or the grammar of Sanskrit into English. You cannot, because the two grammars are different. The two syntaxes are different, right? So you have to translate the meaning of the text rather than the words of the text. But the meaning is arrived at not by some kind of intuition, but by going deep into the words that construct a sentence. Yeah.
A beautiful idea upon which to close our conversation for today. Thank you very much for reappearing on the podcast.
Thank you, Raj, for inviting me a second time. Enjoy talking to you.
Yes, it was my pleasure. And auspiciously, this will be released in some time from now, but you are the first one of 2023.
All right.
So for those listening, we have been speaking with Dr. Patrick Olivelle, a seminal figure in the field of Indian religions. We've been speaking with him about this brand new Primus publication, Reading Texts and Narrating History, which is the third collected volume of his works. And it touches on so many, many things. Trade, science of elephants, courts of criminal justice, penance and punishment, moral philosophy, talking animals, you name it. And you probably will find an article that touches on phenomena. So until next time, keep well, keep listening, and keep contemplating the significance and the power of careful diachronic textual study. Take care.
Thank you, Raj.